and Public Affairs, say March 13, 2003, and we have several public hearings to go through today. We are diverting a bit from the agenda that's been posted, in the order at least, in that we will first hear House Bill 2929 and then House Bill 2813, House Bill 2827, and then if there's time, we will get into 2141. And those who have been involved with this committee before know that we are under some time deadlines, and that we do not have the luxury to go beyond 3 o'clock because there's another committee that meets in this same room. So we'll just kind of see where it takes us. So at this point, I'd like to call forward Donna Butler. Oh, sorry. Open up the hearing on House Bill 2929 and then call forward Donna Butler.
I have some written testimony here.
Okay, if you can give it to the assistant.
And I also brought a couple of visual aids here for you, so that you can get an idea of what I'm talking about here. This staff represents what?
Donna, before you get started, why don't you go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and you might also give us a little bit of your background.
My name is Donna Butler. I'm a resident of Marion County. I'm also a certified public accountant, and I've been practicing in public accountancy since 1978, which is, I'm taking time out to quit generating tax revenue to come testify today. So gives you some idea how important I think this is.
We appreciate that.
I've also been working on campaign finance reporting for 20 years with all different sizes of committees, from city council to governor races, ballot measures. I've done some work with union PACs, the caucus PACs, pretty much a real broad range. What I brought here with me today, this is the primary filings for Ron Saxton for the governor's race, for the primary. This is Kevin Mannix's filings just for the general election. And in addition to those two stacks of paper, I probably filed almost another 200 pages of paper that's in more detailed files back at my office. As you can see, the current reporting requirements generate a whole lot of paper and make it really difficult to find anything that truly matters in those reports. I did bring you some written testimony, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to be real brief here. And if you want to ask questions, please do. In my opinion, what you need to do is form a work group and figure out what transactions should be reported and how they should be reported. I can't even find specific transactions in this pile of paper, and I'm the one that filled out the forms. Anything to reduce this volume is going to save state taxpayer dollars. Two examples, the state law requires the elections division to maintain all of this paper on file for 6 years. In addition to that, every transaction in those reports are key punched into a computer system at the elections division to produce this book, which is the summary report of campaign contributions and expenditures. This particular volume is for the general election of 2000, and estimating there's probably 60,000 entries in this book. This is a huge waste of tax dollars. All of the information in this book are contained in the election reports. This book is a requirement of a specific ORS, which is 260-255, paragraph 2. Because of this book, in my opinion, this is the cause of requiring electronic filing. to try and cut down on the cost of this book. In my opinion, this book is not needed because the only people that are interested in this are people that run the campaigns. This doesn't do the public any good. But there's a whole number of issues within the campaign finance reporting system that needs to be reviewed. Another specific one is occupations. We require everybody that gives a contribution of more than $50 to disclose their occupation or their employer. A lot of contributors feel this is an invasion of their privacy, and it's information they do not want in a public space. I don't want my occupation tied with my home address in a public arena for a number of personal issues. Other people have business issues why they may not want their name and business associated with a particular candidate. This information, if somebody wants to work for it, it is out there. I don't think that's a good use of state dollars to be worrying about reporting that detail of information on people. A really strong recommendation is to look at raising the contribution, reportable contribution limit. The vast majority of these pages up here are related to contributions. A lot of those contributions are between $50 and $100, and an even greater number are between $100 and $200. They produce a lot of clutter, so it makes it difficult to find a $100,000 contribution in these reports. The $100,000, the $50,000, the $10,000 contributions, those are the contributions that the public is interested in. What good does it do to report them if nobody can find them in the report? Also, some of the reporting requirements require that each contribution be reported individually. So if somebody gives six times in a report, it could be spread out on six different pages out of 300 pages. That makes it really hard to track why that person gave it those dates. Why not summarize those entries into one line and just list the dates and the amounts with the name in there once? That would cut down volume, still give the quality of information, and actually that would provide far better information because all one contributor's information is all together. It's just a whole laundry list of items along those lines that really need to be addressed, which is why I've suggested that you form a work group to sit down and take a look and figure out what should be reported and how it should be reported, and then write the law to meet those needs, because this doesn't meet the public's needs right now. And it's costing a lot of tax dollars to produce. Let's see.
Ms. Butler, if I can just ask you, I think probably the primary criticism of these kinds of solutions are that it's going to weaken the disclosure process that we have with the CNAs right now. What do you think about that?
Most of my comments really are geared towards legislative statewide races. There probably should be a different standard for county and city. Most of the races are so expensive now that a $200 contribution really doesn't buy much influence with anybody that's sitting up on that panel. And when you look at it, $200 doesn't cover the postage for a mailing. It probably doesn't even cover the paper for a mailing. It takes a lot of most in a House race, I'd estimate a district-wide mailing probably costs between $4,000 and $6,000. That's an awful lot of $200 contributions. The committees themselves are going to have to keep that detail in order to comply. One of my other suggestions is to look at the examination procedures that are being used by the state currently, because the examination procedures basically consist of a state employee sitting down and reading every entry on all of these reports and making sure all of the boxes are filled out right. This really doesn't encourage the committees to do accurate reports. All they're worried about is making sure the boxes are filled out and not necessarily that what they're reporting is correct. the emphasis on the penalty structure that's used here is on the individual transactions, which means a committee can file a summary report that is highly inaccurate, and there's no penalty for it. And that summary page, the first two pages of each of these reports, that's primarily what the media is looking at and reporting in the newspaper and on the news broadcasts on the day that these are filed. And if you have a $1 million report and you change that $200,000 with amendments, that may or may not ever get picked up by the media. I get criticized sometimes by the elections division people because I will file a report and I will make sure my summary are accurate. If I run out of time, I make sure that summary is accurate because I know that's what the press is going to look at, and I'll fix the detail later because I know the emphasis of what the people want to know, what the voters want to know, is on those summary pages and not listed in all of the detail. If I'm penalized, I'm penalized in the detail, not on the summary. And I think that's a huge flaw in our reporting system, because what the people are getting and picking up on is inaccurate. I understand why a lot of people think reporting every single contribution may be important, every single expenditure may be important, but I don't think the state can afford that level of detail when you look at all of the costs involved in that reporting, because you have the cost to the state taxpayers, you have the cost to the committees. A lot of these committees, as an example on the occupations, is a deterrent to the committees to look to small contributors to run their race. The reason it's a deterrent is because if they get contributions that are $60, they got to make sure they've got a volunteer or a staff person checking to make sure they got the occupation. If they don't have the occupation, they got 7 days to send the letter. If they don't get the letter out on time, then they got to detail somebody to be calling that person or tracking them down and try and talk them out of their occupation, which causes a lot of hard feelings for the contributors. We need to encourage more people to get involved in the elections process, and we need good candidates that are willing to run and having to comply with some of these nitpicky little rules sometimes is a deterrent to candidates to run. Occupations and some of that small detail and small contributions is a deterrent to committees to run on grassroots money versus it's so much easier to go and talk to a corporation, talk to a PAC, talk to the unions to get the funding. I mean, why send out a fundraising letter that's district-wide that's going to cost you $2,000 and, may net you $4,000 or $5,000 if you've got to spend another $500 of staff time going out and getting the occupations and getting all the little contributions reported when you can go talk to, a CEO of some corporation and pick up a $2,000 check? I mean, there's no incentive there to go to the small people and ask them for their support.
Okay. Questions? Members, Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we talk about Section 8 that's been brought to my attention regarding basically what Section 8 is doing is removing the inspection process and then having a complaint process and... Give me some input as to the reasoning on that and how you envision the fees working in the complaints process versus the inspection process if it is now.
That particular process and section needs a lot of work. I tried to give you a starting place of some suggestions, and some of them may have been out there a little bit as a way to get people thinking about changing the process to something new and different. Right now, the examination process is when these reports are filed, an employee sits down and reads the report, re-adds the report, and fills out an exam letter requesting whether the item should be amended or explained or whatever. Then once those are responded to, they're checked off. If they're not responded to adequately enough, then they kick out a penalty notice. That examination process, most of the time, everything on that exam letter is fixed, and the state employees are so focused on the little details, making sure an occupation is complete, or that the address is complete, or that the date. I've actually had to amend reports because I've accidentally put December 31st, 2003 instead of December 31st, 2002. That's the level of detail they're examining those at. There is no or very little true auditing done. Again, I'm a CPA. If I was auditing these, I would never focus on whether or not every single date is correct. If it's obvious that it's a typo, I'm going to skip over it. I'm going to focus in on things like, are the accounts payable reasonable? Is this amount of contributions reasonable? Is it reasonable that the cash is so low, that the cash is so high? Transactions that look unusual, I might ask to look at the invoice. I might review contributor records to see if those aggregates that are being reported are correct. None of those things occur with the current examination process. The penalty structure, and Fred Neal can probably clarify some of this better than I am, is complaint driven. A couple years ago, I came in and started talking to the elections division about a problem with a mayoral race in a very small town and pointed out deficiencies in the reports. The elections division could not do anything with the information I was providing them until I filed a written complaint. Even though it was obvious that there was a problem there, there's no time and no incentive for state employees when they notice a flaw in the report, unless it's something like a missing occupation. There's no incentive for them to pursue that matter. A lot of times opponents don't choose to file a complaint because they're in fear of the complaint backfiring on them. Why not have a process where if one candidate's reports are under review or under audit, that you audit everybody in that race, so it is equal among all of the races and everybody's on the same standard. Spot audits is what the IRS uses and the Department of Revenue uses to try and keep taxpayers in line. They pick an industry or an area of the country where they perceive abuse, and they pick some people and they go in and audit those people. It gets their message out loud and clear to everybody associated with them that they're being followed up on, and it increases the compliance. We could develop that kind of a system here as well.
Just follow
up. Sure, follow up.
So when you say, you started out by saying this needs a lot of work, the way I understand Section 8 and then with this new complaint process, that someone a year and a half after the election could go back and complain about a particular race. And then with the fee structure as it's worded here, then they would be billed. I mean, they would be, fees would be start from the election date or whenever the last report was due till a year and a half later. So when you're saying this needs work, these are the types of issues that would need
right.
to be looked at.
And currently, you have to file a complaint within 90 days of filing of the filing date of the report. If you file it outside the 90 days, then you're out of luck. But, you know, that really does need to be defined. I mean, you have a good resource to come up with audit procedures for the elections report. You have the state audit division. You got auditors on state payroll that could come up with a list of procedures the elections division could use to do audits and define what type of procedures would be appropriate for what kind of complaint or report. The fee structure I've talked about a little bit in there is a way to finance some of this. The filing fees, the miscellaneous committees have no filing fees at all. And they're generating, I mean, a ballot measure committee is filing a huge amount of paperwork. If you're opposing a ballot measure, you never file a fee, but you're using a lot of tax dollars to have your reports reviewed, stored, et cetera. We need a better way to manage our elections that are going to be more cost-effective for the information the public gets.
Thank you. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Butler, for bringing these ideas. I think they're very thought-provoking, and I think there's a lot that could be done. I personally do my own CNEs because I want to be sure that they're accurate and correct and because there is fining involved. However, I have also paid to have them done. And for an election, you know, it's not uncommon for it to be at least $2,000 or $3,000 for that, and probably a lot higher. And I want you to tell me what an average price would be on the ones that you've worked on. And also, my concern is that, you know, the average person is going to find it more and more difficult to even run for election without thousands of dollars just because of the CNE reporting and then the electronic requirement, which requires computer equipment. And I think that is a deterrent to people running. So can you tell me, do you know how many people actually do their own CNEs? Do you have any numbers? I would guess it's very low.
I have no idea how many are doing their own. The candidates I talk to, I discourage candidates from doing their own CNE reports. The reason is the risk is too high to a candidate. Their focus is on getting elected, not making sure all of the occupations are in there, that the bank's reconciled on time, and all of those things. They should be overseeing it and maybe reviewing the reports before they're filed, but they shouldn't be actually filling out the paperwork. They need to find somebody to do that work for it, either find a good volunteer that's willing to do that, or getting stuck with paying somebody to do CNE reports. It's hard for me to give you an average as to what CNE reports cost because I do such a wide range of reports, and the level of services I provide far exceed just doing the CNE report. A number of my clients, I do large committees. A number of them have payroll and other reporting issues. I review some of their opponents' reports and that. So it's really hard for me to estimate a rough guess. If I was just doing CNE reports for, say, a House race, it's probably at least $3,000 to $4,000.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Butler. And if you can hold on just for some more testimony, and then we'll take another closer look at your suggestion for a work group. So then, as she's putting things away, we'll go ahead and call forward Norma Turrell, Janice Thompson, and Andy Miller. And while they are coming forward, I also want to make note, committee, of the written testimony provided by Secretary of State Bill Bradbury relating to this bill. And that's before you, and it will be entered as part of the record. Mr. Turrell?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you for this opportunity to discuss the public disclosure law of campaign contributions. For the record, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm speaking today on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And yes, the League does invite men to be members. I am on the State Action Committee holding the campaign finance reform portfolio. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed citizens' participation in government and provides voter education materials and activities, and you probably already knew that. For more than 30 years, the League has actively advocated for public disclosure of campaign contributions. I myself was originally involved with public disclosure laws in the 1970s in Washington State, where I supported the pioneering public disclosure law that was passed in that state. And I've also been a campaign treasurer in Washington State and had to deal with the campaign disclosure reports at that time. The League believes that HB 2929 would considerably weaken the public disclosure of campaign contributions in Oregon. This bill would increase from $50 to $200 the aggregate size of contributions that would require detailed donor identification of donors. It would eliminate the required disclosure of donors' occupation. It would remove the required examination of campaign disclosure reports by the Secretary of State's office or a county clerk and rely instead on citizens to find and complain about violations. It would prohibit publishing of signatures contained in disclosure reports on the Internet. Like any complex legislation, HB 2929 contains many ideas, some useful and some detrimental. For example, a useful idea may be increasing by a modest amount, say for inflation, the aggregate contribution amount that requires detailed disclosure of donor identification. However, we think that $200 is too much. Encourage public trust in an open government, it might be wiser and more useful to retain the $50 limit. In the opinion of the League, the idea of eliminating the disclosure of a donor's occupation is quite detrimental. If anything, we should be increasing the disclosure so that we also include the donor's employer. This would help reveal attempts to circumvent the disclosure law of corporate and organizational campaign contributions. This disclosure of a donor's occupation and employer would perhaps be required if Oregon adopts campaign contribution limits, which this legislature is also considering. The League also considers to be detrimental the elimination of examination of disclosure reports by the Secretary of State's office and county clerks. Many simple mistakes are caught by this process that otherwise would have to be considered violations. If anything, this is a big service to campaigns, not a big burden. Relying on citizens or one's opponents to find violations is not a consistent or reliable enforcement process. This could only tend to increase the mistrust of voters in our campaign processes. In its current form, the League opposes HB 2929. However, with the elimination of the detrimental ideas as we've outlined, and with the modest addition of disclosure of a donor's employer, the League could then support HB 2929. We hope this committee will fully examine this proposal for updating the public disclosure law. The League would be pleased to work with you to make it happen.
Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
Hold off on questions until the panel's complete. So go ahead.
I'm Andy Miller. I'm Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon. Common Cause is a nonprofit, nonpartisan citizens lobbying organization promoting honest, open, and accountable government. Thank you, Chair Doyle, and members of the committee for giving me the opportunity to testify today. I threw in the mission statement because yesterday when I met with Representative Berger, she had never heard of Common Cause. So I realized I had some work to do in educating. As you are all probably aware, Oregon is one of only six states that has no limits on contributions to political campaigns. In the absence of limits, it's important to have adequate disclosure so that the election process is as open and transparent as possible. Disclosing the source and amount of funds used to finance elections helps citizens evaluate candidates and measures. And I would add there that the occupation often helps to identify the interests of a candidate. For example, if all of your contributions are $50 contributions from farmers, you would tend to think that that candidate will favor farm policy issues. And that helps me as a voter decide if that candidate's ideas would be in line with mine. And that's what I mean by voter education. House Bill 2929 weakens disclosure laws by limiting the amount of information available to voters. In addition to limiting the information available, It will make records less accurate and will reduce the degree of confidence that the voters have in the information. Common Cause requests that any changes made to election law be made with the best interest of the voters in mind. We do not feel that House Bill 2929, as it is currently written, is in the best interest of the voters, and therefore urge a no vote or, listening to the other testimony, a consideration of what changes would make it a better law.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Janice Thompson with the Money in Politics Research Action Project. We're also a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization whose goals are to increase access, accountability, and participation in politics. In its current form, as an organization, we're opposed to House Bill 2929, though there is a provision regarding the covering up of signatures on any reports put on the Elections Division website, which does seem to make sense. Just to be clear about that. As an organization that is, follows campaign contribution spending and lobbying expenditures, we see the change in the evaluation of CNEs by the Elections Division at the state level, by county clerks and city recorders for local races as being a very troubling and significant change. Fundamentally, I think it would mean that when an organization like mine or a member of the public or a reporter looks at a CNE report, there's no assurance that it's complete, that information is basic as, are the numbers adding up right? It just kind of removes a certain level of trust in these reports that we have under this level of review. Is there a need for, having additional inspection and digging into it? Sure. But I don't see that that is facilitated by the current language in the bill. It's much more appropriate to have an impartial review, I think, with clear timeline standards and consequences rather than the reactive, more complaint-driven process that I see as being included in the bill. It's in that way, it seems like it would just really inappropriately change the tone of the current review process. In talking to treasurers, many of whom are volunteers, oftentimes just still kind of learning how to do this, the review process helps them do their job accurately and correctly, whereas shifting to a complaint-driven process would just seem like it would shift it to much more of an adversarial, enforcement. It seems like there's a shift in tone. It's not helpful to really, one, helping treasurers, and two, to just make sure that the information is as accurate as possible. I think the current auditing process, appropriately includes the potential for fines. I would argue that under a complaint-driven process like this, that the potential for fines being higher would increase because errors, many of which are just like inadvertent, would be caught earlier, and there's not the step of working with treasurers to ensure that inadvertent mistakes are not repeated. And then you're kind of like having somebody make the same mistakes over and over again, and they're just going to get dinged with fines, if it's complaint-driven. As an organization, I certainly don't want to, have to start making complaints to try to feel like I can look at the CNE reports and feel like they're accurate. And in general, it seems even less desirable to increase the likelihood, which I think this bill would do, of the situation where competing campaigns would become, as part of their political strategizing, filing complaints on each other's... it just seems like the whole review process would end up being much, much more chaotic and politicized. With regards to increasing the threshold for itemizing information, as an organization that looks at that and tries to, sort out where the money is coming from. As has been indicated, even with the current requirement for just occupation, you can sometimes not still really figure out the fundamental source of the money. And so if anything, I think in adding, as the representative from the League of Women Voters said, the employer would be a better step. One factor it seems to consider in taking a look at this itemization threshold is that right now the $50 is parallel to the $50 political tax credit. If people are going to be eligible for this tax credit benefit, one consideration would seem to be that full disclosure in return for that benefit would seem appropriate. There's been some mention about, you know, well, is there a need to adjust for inflation? I talked to Fred Neal, and he, I know, will correct me if I took my notes wrong. But my understanding of the history is that 1971, the threshold started out at $25, $25. So if you could, you know, take a look at an inflation adjustment in 2002 dollars, that'd be 111. In 1975, this was changed to $100 for statewide races, which would be $336 in 2002 figures, and $50 for all other races, which would be $168 in 2002 monetary value. And that includes local races. In 1995, it was shifted to $50 for all races, which, again, doing the conversion factor to 2002 dollars, $59. So, you know, there's potentially some room there, but I would argue just on an inflation basis, jumping to 200 is too much. I had a chance to do some analysis of, like, you know, what, you know, what the current level of disclosure is and how that would change. And I didn't have time to do it exactly the way I'd want to, so there's going to be a few little caveats here. If you take a look at the primary for the 2000 election, all legislative candidates received contributions that came to a total of just a hair over $5 million. With the current itemization threshold at $50, that meant 7% of those, that $5 million or so, was not itemized. You couldn't tell where the money was coming from. If you jump that threshold to 200, it would jump up to 10%. 17% of the dollars would not be itemized. So that's like almost $1 out of $5. You don't know where it's coming from. And actually, this is a lowball estimate of the dollars that would not be disclosed, because to do this analysis in the time I had, what I did was I had aggregate contributions. So, in other words, if somebody gave $100 each to three different candidates, in the aggregate analysis I did, that would show up as a $300 contribution, so it would look like it would be disclosed. So the 17%, you know, this jump from 7 to 17% is based on a scenario that is aggregating in a way that, like I say, it's, if anything, it's a lowball estimate of the amount of dollars we would not be seeing disclosed. And that just doesn't seem like a good trend to go. If you take a look at the general election for 2000, the numbers shift a little bit. I think this is an indication that oftentimes contributions to general elections are a little higher. So in the general election of 2000, for, again, legislative candidates, the total received was just short of $11 million. In that election, under the current $50, about 2.5% of the contributions were not itemized. You couldn't tell who it was. If you jumped it up to that 200 level, that percent of unitemized dollars would comprise 6%. So again, there's a jump up because overall larger contributions are a fact, you know, are present in the general election. That's why there's the difference between the primary and general. Again, however, that 6% is a lowball figure because, to do this analysis, like I said before, you know, I'm counting it as if it was itemized. If it was an aggregate, somebody gave an aggregate of, like, say, the $300, when in reality, if it was $300 contributions, we wouldn't be disclosed.
Okay, Ms. Thompson,
yeah.
Summarize and wrap up,
yeah.
Because we got
right.
Quite a few others to testify.
So the bottom line is that disclosure is important. We don't have any kind of contribution limits, so there's no options for alternative sources of campaign funding. without any reform steps in place, it seems, you know, very inappropriate to roll back on the disclosure requirements, and the $50 seems more than adequate. If you're interested, I have some additional information that comparing the range of contributions to Oregon races to federal races, which also use that 200. So you're kind of applying a federal, you know, what's the same threshold for itemization as is used at the federal races. So I have some information that kind of shows that that maybe is a little skewed, because the scale in terms of the average contributions to Oregon races is obviously much less than you see at the federal level. So even if there is any interest in boosting it up, boosting it to 200 seems inappropriately high.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? No? Okay. Thank you for your time.
Representative, I do have one. I'm directing this to Andy Miller. You mentioned Common Cause. It was founded by John Gardner. Is that right?
Chair Doyle, members of the community. Yes.
Very good. I just thought I'd check that. Thank you.
In 1973.
Yeah. Right. Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes the testimony on this bill. There are issues that are contained in this bill, I think, and as both parties have agreed, both sides have agreed, are worth considering further. And I am going to be putting a work group together on this that we can be able to report back most likely at about the first part of May, and in part in consideration to those who are going to be part of this work group that have to get through an April 15 deadline for their accounting practices. But for the members of this work group will be Representative Doyle, Chair, Representative Gary Hansen, Morgan Allen, Troy Nichols, Susan Matthews, Donna Butler, Fred Neal, and then representing the Oregon Newspapers Association, Tom Gallagher. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2929 and open up public hearing on House Bill 2813. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, Representative Close is getting to the dais. We have a letter from John Ingram that he would like entered into the record. And I also need to correct, there is an email at your spot dated March 12th. That's an editorial, and in our fervor to get things copied for the meeting, I failed to put the name of the person who had this set out, which is Mr. Balanese, provided this to me. So I just wanted you to know who that came from. I apologize for not putting his name on it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Close.
Thank you, Chair Doyle, and members of the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee. And I am passing out my testimony for hearing these two important election bills. As a Benton County party chair in the early 90s, I was greatly involved in poll watching, absentee ballot issues, and election process. I've come to greatly admire and support the fair and just election process we have in America. Obviously, it's not perfect, and we should be working constantly to improve elections and take advantage of emerging technology. Last session, I introduced House Bill 2087, which was a large bill, amended 7 times, relating to elections. It dealt with the door-to-door collections of ballots, which would have banned it, that the state would pay for return postage on mail ballots, and the problem of quote-unquote rolling registration. Rolling registration is the time period up to the last day of an election whereby registered voters can change their address, update their registration, and be issued a new ballot. And I believe it was put in under the old polling, you know, going to the poll situation, but now we have a different ballot, so there's a problem with being issued a new ballot when we have a mail ballot system where the ballot may already have been mailed. So this is an example of how one must work to improve our new progressive mail ballot system. This session I've introduced House Bill 2813 and also 2827, and I'm only going to present testimony on 2813 because there are others that will be here speaking on 2827. House Bill 2813 would require proof of citizenship for persons registering to vote for the first time.
It was part of House Bill 2087 last session. I have separated it out this session at the request of those who think it should be considered as a separate issue. I think that's a good idea. Though the argument last session was that this was unconstitutional to require this, states like Louisiana have long required documentation of citizenship to vote. It would not violate the federal voter law if copies, not originals, are submitted to county elections. Because we currently have a large influx of immigrants from many parts of the world, both legal and illegal, to our country, I believe it is absolutely necessary that we document which are citizens with the right and duty to vote and which are not citizens. To give you some background data, and I've gotten this off the National Conference of State Legislatures website, which the committee would like the detail, we can get that. And I also have the elections website from the state of Louisiana, information on their registration process. To give you the background data, the National Conference of State Legislatures lists 8 states requiring ID to vote at the polls. 6 more states require ID under certain circumstances. In 9 more states, officials may require ID. 14 states have methods to deal with people who arrive at the polls with no ID. And to my knowledge, Oregon has no provision to require ID to register or vote. Concerning state legislative action, 62 bills dealing with voter ID were considered in 25 states in 2001. Quite a bit of activity, I think, to those who would say, we don't need to do this, and why are we doing this? It's being done all over the country, and I've tried to document that. In 2002, voter ID bills are pending in at least 17 states, and we're not on that list, so I assume it may be much higher because we have voter ID bills as well. I asked the committee to act to close the ID, no ID loophole and ensure that we have valid elections in Oregon. The time to act is now to ensure that the possible problem, and people will argue whether there's a problem or there isn't, but I think the action by so many states shows that there's a possible problem of non-citizens voting. It does not, we want to make sure it does not become a huge problem. I realize that many non-citizens work in America and pay taxes here, and I've gotten that input from people, particularly Canadians, who say, you know, I pay taxes and I work here and I should be able to vote. But that isn't what our law says currently, and that's a whole other subject. Voting is a privilege reserved for American citizens currently, and I believe we should enforce that. Otherwise, it's unfair to those who have worked to gain citizenship. And I also talked to a Canadian today who said that he had come here at 16, gone through the citizenship process, was very proud to be able to vote. His mother had not, and so they have that argument between them, that he felt that it, you know, because people work hard to get that citizenship, those privileges should be for them only, and that they should be verified when we have voting. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Representative Post, for bringing this. And I think it's an issue that we really do need to look at, because when we take a look at the way the races went this last election cycle, and maybe the others too, where there's just a few votes difference between the winner and the loser, if this is necessary, you know, glad to be looking at it.
Thank you, Chair Doyle and Representative Monis Anderson. I hope, and I'm glad you said that, because I don't want this to be seen as a political issue. I think it protects all of us and all parties equally. That would be my hope.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Representative Close.
Thanks.
And Secretary of State Bradbury, come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon.
Members of the committee, I am Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today on House Bill 2813, and I want to appear before you today to express my very strong opposition to this bill. As the Secretary of State and as the Chief Elections Officer for Oregon, one of my most important duties is to make sure that as many Oregonians as possible have the opportunity to exercise their right to vote. There are a lot of ways my office works to achieve that goal. We conduct voter outreach. We provide citizens with information about how to register and how to vote. We also work hard to make sure that there are no unnecessary barriers that would prevent eligible voters from registering or voting. And that's what brings me here today. If enacted, House Bill 2813 would have devastating consequences for our electoral system and our democracy by actively discouraging voter registration and participation. Under current federal law, citizens who wish to register for the first time and choose to do so via the Postal Service must include a photocopy of their identification indicating their current name and address. And at the bottom of every registration card, the citizen is required to sign an affidavit that they are indeed a U.S. citizen. It's important to note that falsely swearing citizenship is already a federal crime punishable as a Class C felony. So the issue here isn't whether Oregonians must be a U.S. citizen in order to vote. That's already clearly established by law. Let me add that the new Federal Election Reform Act that was just recently enacted last October took a long, hard look at this specific issue. And as a result of a bipartisan effort by Senators Gordon Smith and Ron Wyden, they were able to get a system, a registration system and a voting system that works in a vote-by-mail environment where voters do not go to the polls. And this bill undercuts that bipartisan effort in the U.S. Senate. By enacting onerous ID requirements, House Bill 2813 would discourage eligible citizens from registering and voting. House Bill 2813 requires proof of citizenship for everyone wishing to register, whether by mail, in person, or during a registration drive, a voter registration drive, or at the county elections office. Further, the bill details what is acceptable proof of citizenship, either a passport, a birth certificate, or naturalization papers. Now, it's very clear that the bill would be devastating to voter registration drives, as most citizens really just don't walk around with proof of citizenship documents in their pocket. It would also intimidate and discourage citizens from voting. In order to register to vote, a citizen would have to go through the onerous and time-consuming process of digging up a birth certificate, make a copy of it, and then filling out the registration paperwork. Worse, if a citizen couldn't find their birth certificate or their passport, the process to obtain a new one would take weeks, and it also costs a fee to either get a copy of your birth certificate or to get a new passport. So under these conditions, a significant number of Oregonians would simply not participate. This is an unintended consequence that is exactly the opposite of what state government's role should be in safeguarding the democratic process. We should be doing everything we can to encourage eligible citizens to register, not making it harder for them to do so. Finally, there is absolutely no evidence of a widespread attempt by non-citizens to register and vote in Oregon. There's no evidence of that. Therefore, the simple reality is that this bill is unnecessary at best and unconscionable at worst. And I respectfully urge the committee to not move this bill forward.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Secretary Bradbury, thank you very much. I'm referring to your testimony where you're reflecting on a voter registration card, and perhaps I misunderstood you. You said there is an area where a person checks that they're a resident, or
they're a citizen.
They're a citizen, and that they make their signature, which is in basically, I guess it has an affidavit language.
Right.
Did you also say that they're required to provide some sort of documentation to verify their citizenship?
If
mailing it in.
The United States Senate, in their most recent election reform bill, has put in some language that says there's some proof, a copy of which has to be submitted. It is not just a birth certificate or a passport or proof of citizenship. It can be, I don't know the full list, but it's a list that the U.S. Senate came up with that basically would say that if you can show you live here, that's going to cover it. So in other words, you would have to, if you're registering by mail, you would have to submit some proof of residency at the time you currently under federal law.
Okay. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say there's no evidence of non-citizens voting, what type of research has there been done? Do the county clerks follow up on any of this? I mean, how would we know that there aren't non-citizens voting? You say there's no evidence, but it seems like there's been no attempt to find any evidence. Would you concur or not?
Well, I would say that fundamentally the election system is a complaint-driven system. And there are not a significant number of complaints relating to this, so that we have no evidence that there is any kind of a serious problem with it.
And then another question. Usually when I apply for a job, I have to submit a driver's license and then proof of citizen, either a passport or birth certificate. I think there's a list to fill out your W-2 forms. So I'm saying that for most citizens, I don't like having barriers to register, but I would think for most people, at least who work, that wouldn't be a barrier to get your birth certificate or a passport. But your experience is such that would be a significant barrier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. The federal law does require the submission of some evidence of residency. That does not mean that you have to go buy a copy of your birth certificate or get a passport, which takes a long time and costs some money. The federal law does specify that there are some things you have to show as kind of proof of being a resident. And that, to me, you know, that has been, they have really worked out a compromise in the election reform to take into account vote by mail, and this bill takes it a whole lot further and specifies some very specific kinds of identification which do have costs and would take time to get for most people and would therefore create a real stumbling block to registration.
Okay, further questions? Okay, thank you very
much. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
For the record, Senator Bruce Starr, Senate District 15, representing Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to make a comment. If it's okay with the Chair, I'd like to make a comment on both House Bill 2813 and 2827.
Sure. Go ahead.
These are a couple of bills that I'm somewhat familiar with, and having introduced them last session myself. And I do have a Senate bill that's either very similar or identical to House Bill 2827 in the Senate. I'd just like to add my support for these two bills. The citizenship bill, I think all of us recognize the importance that of our constitutional right to vote and how that's fundamental to being an American. As you've heard from the Secretary of State, that it's the devil's in the details about how we go about doing that, and that's the challenge. And I encourage you as a committee to try to wrap your hands around that and figure out what can really work as we hope to have a system where U.S. citizens are the ones that are given that privilege and to cast ballots and vote in the state. I think it's critical. I think it's important. I think we all support that. It's how it gets done. It's the difficult thing. So I'd number one, like to voice my support for that concept. The other bill is the bill that would prohibit our county clerks from opening the ballots, the secrecy envelopes, until Election Day. I think this is an important bill as well in that it protects the integrity of our election system and elections process. One of the objections that was raised in public hearings on this bill last time was the need of a couple of things. The need of counties that had the punch card ballots. They go through and in at least in Washington County, I know they'd open them up and they'd run their hands behind the ballot to knock off the chads, the hanging chads that may be still attached, to get those ballots ready to run through the counters. And they do that ahead of time to make sure that when it came time to actually count those ballots, they were ready to run through the counter. I think you'll receive some testimony here today if the Secretary of State didn't already mention this, but those punch card ballots are on the way out in this state as are going to receive some federal funds to help do that. And that particular objection, I think, will no longer be a valid one. One of the other objections that was raised last time is just the space required to hold all these ballots and not provide the opportunity to count them and the possibility that we'll actually have to wait a little longer to find out who's won and who's lost on Election Day. I would submit that while those may be valid concerns, that the integrity of our voting system and voting process overrule some of those concerns. And the opportunity for mischief, I'm not saying that there is or has been mischief, but I think the opportunity for mischief as it relates to the integrity of our voting process, voting system, is there, and that this is one small thing, one small improvement that I think we can make to guard the integrity of that voting process. And I'd urge you to consider carefully this bill, or both these bills, and hope that you can find a way to get a majority support for them and move them through the House. With that, I appreciate the opportunity just to kind of give my two cents worth and cheer as you work these two important issues. Be happy to answer questions if necessary.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Starr, as an elected senator from Senate District 15, have you heard from what type of responses or inputs have you had from constituents in your Senate district about either or both of these issues?
Well, primarily just that there's the possibility that because of the process that is used today, that there's a possibility that it could open up our system to abuse, and that's the primary thing that I've heard from constituents. I believe that House Bill 2827 has been introduced at a request of Mike Balanese, who happens to be one of my constituents. So I think that those are the kinds of things that we are trying to and hoping to prevent with these bills. I'm not saying that there's been wide reports of widespread fraud or abuse out there today, but I think that the potential there exists, and that again the integrity of our system really requires us to do whatever we can to make sure that those things aren't available.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Let's see. Jim Ludwig, and then we'll have Don McIntyre come up as well. Mr. Ludwig, we understand you have a time concern here, so we'll...
I've got a two-month-old granddaughter who needs a babysitter,
okay.
And you're looking at him.
Okay. Well, we'll let you move on quickly. And
thank you, and I will be quick. Chairman Doyle and members of the committee, my name is Jim Ludwig. I live at 7500 Southwest Leibold Road in McMinnville, Oregon. I'm here in support of House Bill 2813. To me, the bill is just common sense. And I was at a small gathering last night, and I mentioned to a number of people I was going to testify at the legislature today, if I could find parking. And I mentioned what I was going to testify on, a bill that would require proof of citizenship to register to vote. And all I got was blank stares. People thought, don't people have to do that already? It's really only common sense that people have to show their citizens in order to vote. If citizenship is required to vote, logically, we should ask for verification of it. I have a friend who I communicate with who lives in Mexico, Alan Wall, and he's married to a Mexican citizen, and he comes back to the United States about 6 weeks out of the year, and we communicate back and forth. He told me he goes with his wife to vote in Mexico. He can't vote because he's a non-citizen of Mexico, but he said every registered Mexican voter has an ID card complete with a photograph, fingerprint, a holographic image to prevent counterfeiting. At the Mexican polling station, there's a book containing the photograph of every voter in the precinct. A book is available to the poll workers and observers from various parties. If there's any doubt to somebody's identity, they look it up in the book. The Mexican voter's thumb is smudged with ink. The ink stays on there for 3 to 4 days. That way nobody can go from one polling booth to another. I mean, when Vincente Fox won his election down there, which was a huge upset, there was no complaints about hanging chads or Florida votes or anything like that. A marked contrast to what we've had in the United States. And the U.S. Census Bureau recently stated that we have in the United States upwards to 9 million illegal aliens. The INS reported that as of the year 2000, in the state of Oregon, we had 90,000 illegal aliens, and that's 173% increase in illegal aliens over the previous 4 years from 1996. Well, if we had 90,000 illegal aliens in this country at the year 2000, we obviously have over 100,000 right now. Because it's so easy to vote and not be identified, I don't think anybody can say with any confidence that there aren't people voting in our elections who aren't eligible to vote. And I'll take exception to Secretary of State Bill Bradbury, who said you can't prove that it's happening. Well, I don't think you can prove that it's not. It's incomprehensible to me. It's so easy to vote that people who would just be part of the process and feel they have a right to vote, even though they're not citizens. To me, voting is one of the most important things I do as a citizen. One of the most important things you do as lawmakers is to make sure only people who can vote, vote. We all should have the confidence that the people who voted in our elections can legally do so. And I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? No? Thank you. Appreciate your coming in. And congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Mr. McIntyre, and while you begin your testimony, Mr. Bellanese and Ms. Bendel, if you can come forward.
Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, since there are two bills, may we testify on both just in the interest of time?
Let's go ahead and you can go ahead and do that.
The citizenship one is short and the other one's pretty short too, but yeah. I just thought it would save the round robin.
Yeah. If you could just hold just a moment. Let me then go ahead and open up a public hearing, joint hearing on the two bills, 2813 and 2827. And for those of you, we're going to still focus on 2813 for the as we look at the order of the testimony. Those of you that are signed up on 2813 will be heard first, then 2827 will go after that. Go ahead.
Chairman Doyle, members of the committee, I'm Don McIntyre of Gresham. I'm here on my own account, but I'm representing the sentiments of a number of citizens that I associate with, people who are very interested in the integrity of our political system, and by extension, of course, the way we vote. One of the things that I couldn't help think about was the Secretary of State's testimony where he said proving your citizenship was onerous and to ask someone to prove their citizenship was unconscionable. And I think that's a little bit overstated rhetoric. And I do not know what motivates him to say things like that, but if he is correct, then it would be onerous for you to show your birth certificate to get a passport. Or how about to receive Social Security? Be unconscionable to put you through that. If you're a citizen and you have a residence, you ought to be entitled. The other thing I was thinking about, too, and I'm here, by the way, to defend the honor of Representative Close, because there was... There was an editorial in the Corvallis newspaper the other day. It was unbelievable. But essentially, the editor said Representative Close was being mean-spirited by wanting citizens to vote. And when I say citizens, I mean that. Because the editor thought, well, if someone's working here, they ought to be able to have a say in what goes on. So what the editor, what she's saying is that she wants non-citizens voting, and so when you see that there is a tendency on the part of some in our civilization that would like to see that, then that's a good solid argument on why we should have more safeguards. Now I'll segue into the other measure, and that is the opening the envelopes on the same day as the election. Currently, the government opens envelopes up to 7 days in advance. I hated to see the old system of voting go away. That was when, as neighbors, we went to, on a special day, we went to a special place to exercise our liberty, our prerogative. And I love the Norman Rockwell part of it. But there was a practical part of that, too. The reason for polling places, and our founder said, you'll go to a place to vote on a day. One of the main reasons for that is when you show up to vote in a precinct, there's somebody looking at your face, connecting it to your signature. Identification, integrity of the process is the point of a polling place. So, since we haven't done that, we now have a system where we treat voting like it's junk mail. There are these hundreds of thousands of ballots out there floating around in the ether, and I have my own experience with that, trying to get out a vote for Senator Smith. The first time he ran for election under vote by mail, I would knock at a door and I'd say, is John Jones here? Well, no, John Jones isn't here. Well, I said, the precinct walking list says that he's a Republican and he lives here. He hasn't been here for 18 months. Well, I said, okay, the election's off, said so. They said, well, his ballot's here. And I ran into that in half the doors that I knocked on. One other little anecdote, I got a vote-by-mail ballot one election in the mail, and my wife did not get one. And we waited a couple of days, and then I called up the elections office. I said, my wife didn't get a ballot. Oh, okay, we'll send out another one. And so I said, well, is the first one out there floating around in space somewhere? And they said, yeah. And I'm thinking about how valuable ballots are, that we send these ballots to the government to sort and count. Many of the issues that we vote on affect the government and the government class. So you can understand that if these ballots, which have been separated from the ID, the name of the person on the envelope, it gives me the creeps. Piles of unidentifiable ballots sitting on tables in darkened elections offices 7 days in advance of an election. Now, call me a paranoid, but it does give me the willies to think about that. So what we are proposing, or we are supporting, is that ballots be open on the same day starting at 8:30. The hard work in vote-by-mail is checking off those signatures. So they do that, they get them stacked up, and there are machines that will open envelopes. Some of them will open envelopes at 20,000 envelopes an hour. Depends on how sophisticated you want to get. In Multnomah County, you'd need some pretty sophisticated machines because of the large amount of ballots. But I also understand that there's federal money available now to help us improve our election system. A smaller machine would work in Grant County or somewhere like that. So I ask you to pass on support both of these bills to help preserve the integrity of our great system of elective politics.
Thank you. And pursuant to your request, I don't think we need a motion, but you are a paranoid, Ms. Mick. Mr. Bellady.
Is that the ruling of the chair?
from the chair.
That's tough for me to follow. Chair Doyle, members of the committee, my name's Mike Balanese, and you have copies of my testimony, I trust. I'm from Hillsboro. I'll speak to House Bill 2813. 2 years ago, as Senator Starr stated, I was one of the people behind the proof of citizenship. Since you have my testimony, just to touch on a couple, this editorial that Don referred to goes to using the honor system as the registration form now is. It's an affidavit. It's the honor system. I say that the honor system is not sufficient when it comes to something as sacred as registering to vote. Being mean-spirited against people who would show their proof of citizenship. I am a second-generation Italian-American, and this is the only time I've ever used that. When my four grandparents came from Italy, they were proud to show their citizenship that they obtained after they immigrated and were proud as heck when they registered to vote. They were not afraid to show their proof of citizenship. It's not against federal law. It does not violate federal law to require this. Last session, we heard from individuals that protested this bill, and it would put a crimp in their style when it comes to registering people to vote at rock concerts, I quote, and at booths at the state fair. And as I believe Secretary of State Bradbury said, people don't ordinarily bring their birth certificate or proof of citizenship to those events. Well, then I might say that those events probably might be improper venues to do something as important as register people to vote. Opponents will deny knowledge that there's any incidents of illegal people, illegal registrations. We've already heard that. I'm going to ask the rhetorical question. How do they know? How would anyone, including myself, find out? And I would ask this question. Does anybody in this room know for an absolute fact that their next door neighbor is a United States citizen or not? Or if they vote, do you know if they are a United States citizen? I don't know if my neighbors are. So how do we know that the integrity of this system is in place? One other thing on this bill is that before we went to vote by mail, there didn't seem to be a problem with voter registration. And I'm going from notes here, and I'm going to get off of this. Do you want me to go into the other bill on?
Sure.
While I'm on a roll. This is House Bill 2827. On the secrecy envelopes. As Don stated, I too have just, I cannot get over signing my name to something that has my ballot on the inside, especially now when I see that they put the party of registration on the outside of the envelope. They also place barcodes on these envelopes, on the outer envelope. And for anyone to say that they can't open envelopes on election day, because of space, I'll repeat, what is more important, the integrity of the elections or finding a way? I don't believe in the word can't. I don't believe in the word that it's impossible. I believe that it doesn't want to occur for a reason. In Washington County, where I live, ballots were placed in a mail slot that had a sign hanging over it. I wish I had taken a picture of it now. It said, you can place your property tax payment or your ballot in this mail slot. Is that what voting has come to, that we can put ballots and commingle them with property tax payments? I suggest not. I believe the sworn election staffers should man these cardboard boxes that are placed around libraries, etc., that are in hallways at the county building. At one time they were. Because I believe that a ballot box is more important than a cardboard box that is sitting unattended. You will hear that this isn't a solution in search of a problem. It is not. It is a means of guaranteeing the integrity of the election system, which I claim and I adhere to and respectfully submit to you is one of the most important things that I do. And that's why I respectfully ask you to approve both bills 2813 and House Bill 2827. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name's Ruth Bendel. I'm a private citizen, and I live at 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive, Portland, Oregon. I'd like to first address something. A question was asked earlier on about 2813, House Bill 2813, of Representative Bruce Starr, in terms of the kind of complaints, etc., that people are giving about the system. I have brought with me copies of sheets of paper with people who signed up in December in support of both the bills, both House Bill, the contents of the bills of 2813 and 2827. And I would like to see that some way is made so that I get early enough notification about any future hearing or discussion about the contents of these bills, because close to 100 people have signed up saying that they feel this is an, both these bills are an absolute necessity. Now I'll move on to 2813 in particular. I'd like to make a suggestion for making things even easier with the requirement for proof of citizenship. I do believe that the voter registration application itself should include some specific questions that if a person is unable to answer those questions besides doing this affidavit, that there should be, a flag should go up. I think they should be asked for their birth certificate number, the state and county of birth, even including the hospital if necessary. B, the option should be their U.S. passport number and when first issued, and C, their naturalization certificate number and when issued. All of these certificates have numbers, and I do believe that by including those questions on the voter registration card and then saying accompany that with a photocopy of whatever particular certificate you have is an absolute necessity. I think that it acts as a deterrent in many ways to a normally honest person that this is something I cannot do. Most people avoid getting caught. So if there are specific questions, these are the things that you need to answer as to whether you are eligible, I think that in itself will go a long way. The other thing that I wanted to point to is not only is the state of Louisiana requiring proof of citizenship, our neighboring state, Washington State, as of this year, apparently, has already started to require proof of citizenship, so that we would not be alone, and I don't think there's too many people complaining about it. We go into to apply for a job, and we're required to fill out an I-90 and prove citizenship, or to have naturalization papers, or something that says that we are eligible to work in the United States. People don't seem to find that too onerous. You go to get a driver's license, you've got to prove, bring other documents with you. And Mr. Balanisi came up with a suggestion that even there should be a box on our driver's license. Citizen, yes. Citizen, no. Just so that that could then be approved. But all in all, I just do not see that anything is too onerous or that it is unconstitutional, because if it's unconstitutional, how come two other states already have that requirement in action? I'd like to now slip to 2827 and bring to your attention the fact you want to know if there's any kind of incidents that have happened in terms of opening ballots before election day. I'm not going to give the person's name. They're elderly and it doesn't matter anymore. But I became aware of this opening of ballots prior to election day simply because the Thursday before a school election, I was called by a well-meaning resident that was working at county elections and told what the results were already looking like based on his work at county elections, and that I should get out, you know, make some effort to get some people to get their ballots in a particular area. Now, at that time, I had no knowledge that other people weren't doing it, but certainly by his conversation, I knew that he was not the only one that was tipping off the trend in an election outcome. And people are human. The people that are hired by county elections, they're people that are willing to come in for the minimum wage and give their time. Many of them are very interested. We're not putting those people through a lie detector test or anything to see whether they are gossiping among themselves or with other interested parties. It's human nature. That's why I say we need to keep this process so that it only takes place on election day. I do thank you for listening, and I do request that you support both of these bills. I think the time is now, particularly during this dangerous period we're all living in and going through inconveniences. Thank you. Okay. And I've got written testimony.
Okay, if you can submit that to her assistant.
I have one footnote, Mr. Chair, if I may. It occurred to me that if we were talking, I mentioned an envelope opening machine to get these envelopes open on election day. I would like to see some thought devoted to this concept, that if we stayed opening these until election day, we could get it down to one envelope. We wouldn't need a secrecy envelope. You'd put the ballot inside the outer envelope, your signature's there, stays with it until it's time to open them. One advantage of keeping the signature along with that ballot is that if we ever wanted to do an audit to make sure that the election was efficacious, that would be beneficial.
Thank you very much.
Paula Kane and Margaret Knoll. And ladies, just seeing you both represent the League, if it's possible to consolidate testimony. Thank you. Great. Great, thank you. And we'll leave it to you to do both 2813 and 2827.
Right. We'll try to combine them. Chair Doyle, committee, thank you for the opportunity.
opportunity to speak to this committee on both of these bills. For the record, I'm Paula Crane, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and this is Margaret Noel, also representing the League, who has been, for the last several years, our voter service chair and has been working with many of the issues which you will be discussing in these bills. The League is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization and encourages informed citizen participation in government and which provides voter education services. The League reaches its legislative positions after research, discussion, and member agreement. We are here today to oppose both of these bills as an obstacle to voter participation. And concerning 2813 first, the League of Women Voters believes that voting is a fundamental citizen's right that must be guaranteed. We support a voter registration process which is accessible, easily understood, and easy to implement and administer. By requiring new voters to supply proof of citizenship with their registration forms, House Bill 2813 would add an extra layer of complexity to the voter registration process and make it less accessible. We believe this would discourage new residents to swear or affirm that they are citizens with sufficient penalties for false statements. Already, the Federal Help America Vote Act requires people to supply proof of identity with a mail-in registration. Acceptable proof of identity includes items such as a driver's license, utility bill, or paycheck stub, which people either normally carry with them or can easily find. Documents like birth certificates, naturalization papers, or passports are often kept in safe places like a safe deposit box and less easily procured. An example I'd like to use was when my son was a high school senior and was taking his American Civics class. Once a month, within the last week of that month, the teacher would have a birthday party for every student in that class who had their 18th birthday. And part of the process is they would fill out their voter registration forms. This was a civics class, of course. They filled out their voter registration form, signed it, and he took it in. Now, I know that my son would not have had the foggiest idea where his birth certificate was. He probably did know where his passport was, but he would have had to go to the bank and get it. This is making it harder for teachers to be able to produce these types of citizen education activities in their classroom. Because people generally do not carry these citizen papers around with them, the requirements of HB 2813 would hamper efforts to register voters at the DMV, other government offices, or a voter registration drive. Okay, since we're combining these two, this is 2827. The League of Women Voters believes that voting is a fundamental citizen's right that must be guaranteed. The League also believes that elections should be conducted in a manner which encourages voter participation and that citizens are entitled to voting procedures which provide ease of ballot access and use. House Bill 2827 would make voting more difficult and less attractive by limiting the numbers of drop-off sites. The ease of depositing ballots at a neighborhood library, store, or a 24-hour drop site would be sufficiently lessened by the proposed requirements that every site be staffed at all times by an elections official. Even dropping a ballot through a mail slot at an elections office at night would no longer be possible. In addition, the proposal to prevent opening of ballots until election day would unnecessarily delay the process. We believe that voting in Oregon can be made secure from fraud without these obstacles. The League of Women Voters urges you to vote against both of these bills. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And anyway, we've got only about 10 more minutes, and there's a chance we can extend a couple of minutes into 3 o'clock without disrupting the next committee coming in. Thank you. But let's see if we can call for Kelly Taylor, ODOT.
forward to your brief testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation, and I was going to make this brief. I just wanted to let you know that we have worked our bidder fiscal. We're trying to assess what the workload is for us. And the reason we do that is because this is one issue where we cannot spend highway fund dollars. When it has to do with voter registration. We have looked at it. We believe that most people who do renewals or duplicates have already registered to vote, so very few, a small number would be registering for the first time. Mostly it would be people coming from out of state, our original licenses, that would be registering for the first time, and they most likely will not have these documents with them. So instead of us sending the registration voter registration document on to the Secretary of State's office, we would be turning them away with the registration form to go make the documents and send it in themselves. So we do think there would be a decline of registration forms sent by us to the Secretary of State's office. The fiscal at this point is about $60,000, a little bit less, and we just want you to know what it was. We can do it. It's a little extra work. It's about, so far, equal to about one FTE. So just wanted you to know where we're at.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Peter Dane. Mr. Dane. Oh.
Well, good afternoon, Chairman Doyle and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here. For the record, my name is Peter Dane. I live at 4355 Dolphin View Way in Salem, over by Chemeketa College. And on considering a House Bill 2013, I urge that it be enacted into law based on its merits. It would protect the right of citizens to vote in elections. The recent close elections demonstrate a need for credibility in the voting process. The secret ballot and the election process are the cornerstone of democracy. It took hundreds of years of struggle to obtain these liberties. Those interested in voting should honor that right by validating their citizenship. But citizens can't take a couple of hours to find their birth certificate, the proof of citizenship that means they don't respect this country and the right to vote. As you probably learned from American history, this country went through a long period of machine politics, culminating in Tammany Hall, where votes were bought and the voting system was manipulated. If you read the newspaper with exploding demographics, Oregon is headed in this era. I don't think people should be coy with the Constitution, and I urge that House Bill 2813 is voted on and guided through to a safe passage. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? No? Thank you.
No.
Okay. Let's see. Have the Association of County Clerks, and then it's going to be Annette Nottingham, and Jenny Kingsley,
yeah.
And then we will wrap up with Mr. Drunkenmiller after this.
Hi. For the record, I'm Annette Nottingham, and I'm from Lane County. I'm representing the Association of County Clerks, and this is testimony in opposition to House Bill 2827. First of all, Section 1, which delays the opening of the return envelopes to 8:30, would have significant impacts to the Election Day process and ballot results. The impact would vary depending on the options available to the individual 36 counties. In order to process all ballots received on election days, there's really two options. The first one would be that we would have to have space available and personnel source resources to hire, train, and supervise large volumes of temporary staff. And an elections office would have to significantly increase the size of their operations on election days to be able to open, pre-inspect, and count the ballots. Or the other option is, provided there wasn't adequate space nor adequate personnel resources, then they would have to continue that counting process over a period of days following the election. For example, Clackamas, Washington, and Lane counties have voter registration in the range of 190,000 to 240,000 and currently utilize temporary staff for the opening of the opening and the pre-inspection, duplication, and ballot counting. And that we have estimated to be from 3,000 to well over 3,200 hours, and that's staff hours. That's just for those particular functions. We have other extra help that we use that day. If those same hours were required on election day, we're talking about a range of 400 to 500 staff people we would have to hire to accomplish that on that same day. Our problem is those three counties do not have the space to put that many staff people, nor the resources to oversee and supervise that staff to do the functions in an accurate and efficient manner to conduct the election. As a result, the ballot processing would carry over a period of days, likely through the Friday after the election. Even if some of the counties were able to rent additional space and hire adequate workers to process all ballots by election day, a delay in ballot results would be an issue. And for example, is that if we started at 8:30, we do have two letter openers that are very, very rapid, and we use them both. But in that event, we still would take a period of time to open all the ballots and be able to get them ready so that the pre-inspection boards could start. That process takes a minimum of 2 hours when it's just a portion of all the ballots. And then you would start the counting process. And this is punch cards, which is much faster. If we had optical scan, that process would be reduced even further. So therefore, the 8 p.m. results would have minimal amounts. That's even if we hired all the staff we had no limitations on resources, and we could buy a new building or whatever we had to do. So that would be a concern, because there is an incredible amount of pressure. We realized at the last presidential election that results were expected on a timely basis. On the other sections of the bill, Section 3, primarily we have the concerns on. And the Lane County is a good example of a significant impact to the drop sites. We have about 18 drop sites in Lane County, and 11 of them are 24-hour mailboxes. And they're very well-received in our county. It provides 24-hour service, and we have them in Florence, Springfield, Eugene, all throughout the county. We would have to close them. There's no way you could staff them. And I understand we need to go a little faster, so I'll try to sum it up. And the other concern is dealing with the ballot security. And I do want to mention this issue, because security of people counting ballots at remote locations is not a comfortable issue. And I know you have high concerns of the security of ballots and the ballot process. We have other issues that deal with the security. I've listed it here in my testimony. I'll let you read that so that you can take a look at it. But counting ballots at remote locations by extra help staff is not a really good idea.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, just for the record, I'm Jenny Kingsley, Washington County Elections Manager. I don't have written testimony. I want to say that I concur with everything my colleague Annette has mentioned. And just a couple of quick things I do have to respond to based on the previous testimony. We live for the integrity of elections, and I just want to assure you that as we are processing our ballots and opening them prior to election day, they are not sitting around in dark desks and overflowing on the floor in an unrestricted manner. We have them double locked inside of our election offices and secured, and every election office in the state has a security plan on file with the Secretary of State's office. So I just want to assure you that, in fact, the ballots as we are processing them are very safe and secured. They are not tampered with. No one has any intention of tampering with election results. I was very disheartened to hear Citizen Ruth Bendel mention that someone on our staff called her, and I would very much like to know who that person is, because that is clearly against the law. And I would press charges against that individual had I known about it. And that's all I would like to say to you this afternoon. I'm open to questions. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Annette a couple questions about what she said. When we had poll elections for many years, we had the results in one day. And even with the hiring of polling people, many more people, and even with the transporting of ballots, we had the results in one day. Now you say you need 5 days to accomplish the task, and that'll be $300,000 additional. one of the arguments made for the mail ballot was the ease of voting and the quick tabulation of the results. That you seem to be indicating that is not what has happened. So were the poll elections cheaper and faster?
Well, poll elections were definitely not cheaper. I can tell you that. We've reduced our cost by well over $100,000 in Lane County alone for an equivalent election. The most people, we had about 50% of our voters preferred to vote by mail, and we're doing it by absentee, and it took us through Friday to count all the ballots at a poll election for the absentee, so results were not all complete by election day.
Paula?
Paula?
If you save money then on the mail ballot, couldn't you conceivably take your savings and put it into machines to open envelopes?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close. That would... It's rather difficult to know that answer because $100,000 really doesn't go too far. I don't know if that would really pay for the amount of staff that we'd have to do that. It's really a time element and a space issue for one day only. It's difficult to manage elections for a peak period and have it year-round, those space requirements and the staffing that you would have to train to be efficient at the job that they're doing. So there's some challenges. It's not like you hire people and they do it all the time and are good at what they're doing.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Steve Drunkenmiller.
Hey, Mr. Chair, well, he's coming up. We have letters for the record from Marion County Clerk Al Davidson and Multnomah County Director of Elections John Kaufman.
And those will be entered in the record. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Steve Druckenmiller. I'm the Linn County Clerk, and I promise I will not inflict myself upon you very long.
Thank you.
What I would like to do is I'm kind of a rare dying breed among county clerks, and some of my colleagues wish I could do that a little bit faster than what I'm doing. But I am here to speak in support, conceptually, of the idea of proving citizenship for registration. I do not believe that in Linn County or any place in the state of Oregon we have had any sort of widespread problem, even small spread problem on this issue. It doesn't mean that we can't. But the bigger issue is the perception of the integrity of elections, some of which you've heard from people who have testified in support of this bill today. They're not right, but that problem is there, and I think this could be a way of solving it. If you ask me, how do we do it without in some sort of impediment to the voter, I don't know yet. Maybe we can think of a way. But I did want to speak in support of that. I can be even quicker with the other bill in that what you heard from the two county clerks speaking before me, election representatives from their counties, is true. And I wouldn't come here, I wouldn't lie to you, I wouldn't tell you this is something other than what it is. It was just administrative convenience. I have the greatest respect for Representative Close. We are friends. And I would urge her to please come into my office and spend some time with my staff and myself while we process ballots. And we will see the difference between poll election processing and vote by mail. And I can assure you, one of the longer things involved with vote by mail is the integrity of the whole process and accounting for the ballots that we receive. We do process ballots differently with vote by mail than we did at poll elections. And it's a tremendous improvement, not only for the accuracy of elections, but for the integrity of it, too. And with that, I thank you for having me, and I try not to come up here too often. I average about once a year, so we might not see each other again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. I'm sorry, question?
Steve, while we have you here, and since you may not return, could I just ask you, there's been an idea that we, if we did say that the envelopes had to be opened 8:30 in the morning election day, and the idea of going to one envelope so you wouldn't have to open two, could you just address what that would do to your workload?
One, I don't think it would be an improvement in the perception of the whole election. When we started vote by mail many years ago, we had one envelope. And we had many, many constituents who were contacting you saying, we don't like the idea of putting that envelope into one other envelope where our signature is, because then it's very easy for people to see how we voted. and hence was born the secrecy envelope. It was a step to ensure the secrecy and the integrity of everybody's ballot. I don't think really it would add that much to the time. Where we find we spend the time is actually accounting for every single ballot. And I wish I had more time to take you through how a ballot goes through a clerk's office in vote by mail as opposed to a poll election, because it becomes obviously clear why we need that much time, and you would appreciate why we do it. Because we have increased the integrity of elections, despite what some people might think, with vote by mail than we ever had with poll elections. And I have worked both. And may I say, too, that I have gone to optical scan ballots in the year 2001, and processing those takes as much or more time than did the punch cards.
Okay. Thank you.
I have just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure, follow-up.
I know we're out of time.
Yep.
The question that came up about separating the signature envelope from the original envelope. Mm-hmm. Some signatures you can't read very well. So if you have a period of time in there, the worry is that when you separate that envelope, and then I assume you destroy the original envelope, is there any chance that you cannot identify that ballot once it's separated from its outer envelope?
Once that ballot is separated in the secrecy envelope from the outer envelope, by virtue of how we process ballots by administrative rule from the Secretary of State's office, there's absolutely no way that you can ever tie that back to anybody. None.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And just as we proceed through on this issue, Mr. Druckenmiller, we may be looking to have you come back to talk some more about it. So thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, committee, for your indulgence. As we go through late sessions, you know, we tend to get backlogged a bit, but I appreciate your patience on dealing with these issues. And the Rules Committee is now adjourned.
Thank you.